We'll move on to item 7, presentation from Veris regarding the coronavirus and its impact on market conditions. Tim Price is going to introduce Veris and Ian and Scott to us.
Tim? Thanks, Mr. Chair. As we look at the investment program, I think it's important to remember what we can control when we're facing a very uncertain public health emergency, economic contraction, and obviously the turmoil in the financial markets. And the main tools we have really come down to asset allocation, diversification, and rebalancing. And so I have asked Ian Toner, the Chief Investment Officer of Veris, and Scott Whalen, Executive Managing Director of Veris, to join us here. And the reason I asked Ian and Scott is Ian's done a lot of work on understanding shocks to the system and how they're incorporated into asset allocation reviews and really into the risks that clients are willing to accept. And so Ian's going to walk us through what's going on in the markets and how that shows up in asset allocation and how that shows up in terms of responses. I asked Scott Whalen to join us because Scott was instrumental in working with the board back in 2015 when we crafted the asset allocation that we have in place today. It's largely unchanged since 2015. We've made tweaks around the margins, but really the main structure of the three portfolios working together for liquidity, long-term growth, and risk diversifying, that structure was really crafted in 2015, and Scott was instrumental in working with the board to build some understanding around that. So I'm going to turn it over to Ian and Scott at this point, and just, please feel free to pepper them with questions, and hopefully they're going to provide you all with the comfort level that the approaches and policies that we've had in place for years now are up to the task of responding to unprecedented market environments. Ian and Scott?
Thanks, Tim. This is Scott, and before Ian gets started, I just want to say it's very nice to hear all your voices again after quite some time, although I do see some of you frequently at some of the conferences. And then I just wanted to say that it's kind of awkward with this telephonic format to do a presentation and respond to questions like it would be if we were in person real time. But if you do want to chime in, feel free to just interrupt and we'll deal with the awkwardness, or you can certainly wait till the end if that's your preference. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ian.
Thank you very much, Scott and Tim, and thank you all very much indeed for inviting us to participate in your meeting. As Scott said, please interrupt at any point with questions that you have. I think you have materials that were sent round. Obviously, as it's a fast-moving environment, things have changed since these slides were put together. But they give you a general picture of what's happening, and with daily updates, it's impossible to keep everything completely fresh. So we'll quickly run through what we've been seeing in the marketplace and as the disease has progressed and how we've been thinking about it. And I hope that can give you some help to understand where things are going. So we begin on page 2. Obviously, there are people around the table who know these data better than anyone in the investment industry. But the reality is this disease affects old people. It affects sick people, but it also affects young people just at a slower rate and healthy people just at a slower rate. And that's the reason why it's having such a broad impact. It is infectious, and it has taken off globally. We're tracking these case data day by day. In fact, we've been tracking it at Veris. I think our first conversation about this in our morning meeting was sometime fairly early in January. So we've been tracking as it developed, tracking the investment industry failing to properly understand it. For a long time, the investment managers were really focused on this as being like SARS, which it clearly isn't. We know that diseases follow a fairly standard disease progression, so we've been tracking the up ramp of the disease around the world. Page 3 covers the effect on the economy of the disease and the way in which countries around the world have been dealing with the disease. and particularly focused in the United States. And the investment industry has essentially gone from, as I said, the SARS analysis, which was some people will get sick, but we know that there will be a very small impact and will snap straight back. The term people used a lot was V-shaped recovery. And instead, a few weeks ago, the industry started to say, okay, this is going to be big, but still we're going to come back by third quarter. And you can see that number on the bottom left-hand side of this page in the U.S. GDP growth projections. I suppose if there's one thing to take away from this presentation, it's that anyone that tells you that they know exactly what the economic impact is going to be is not telling you 100% of the truth, because nobody knows exactly what the economic impact is going to be. And the reality is the forecasting simply has to be, it's going to be significant, and it's going to be for some time. But particularly for a U.S. investor, from the U.S. market standpoint, the U.S. remains an incredibly powerful economy with incredibly highly qualified and competent people, with an infrastructure that's second to none, with a capital market that's second to none. So on the way out of this event, there will be good things that will happen in the United States. It just depends how long it's going to take. So consumer sentiment has been hit. Small business sentiment has been hit. We're particularly concerned about the companies that small to medium-sized enterprises, many of whom have difficulty accessing proper capital markets. They're reliant on banks, and they have maybe undercapitalization, and they have cash flow issues they need to deal with. And the shutdown that we're seeing obviously impacts them. And as we know, the majority of U.S. individuals are employed by smaller rather than larger companies. And so the impact on the population is not insignificant. Page four, the U.S. monetary response, which is you'll all be familiar with the world with the word pumping, pumping money into the economy. The Fed has been very proactive indeed in terms of both making money available by cutting the interest rate, making money available by expanding their balance sheet, and intervening extensively in the repo market and elsewhere to make sure that the plumbing system behind the financial market continues to work. They have been successful in many ways in that. Some of the strains we were seeing in financial markets were alleviated by the Fed's involvement. They still are not able to solve the underlying problem. This is not a crisis of confidence. This is everyone being told to stay home and many people getting sick. And that doesn't respond to cuts in interest rates and expansion of central bank balance sheets. But at least what they're able to do is try and keep the economy moving as much as possible in that environment. And on page five, we see the other half of the government balance sheet, as it were, the legislature and executive working together to try and support as much as possible the economy, focused on people, focused on businesses, and trying to get money as quickly as possible into the economy. Now, the problem, of course, you'll remember the last time around, the much-vaunted shovel-ready jobs, where it turned out there weren't enough shovels, there wasn't much readiness, and there weren't many jobs that came out of it. We have the same problem here. Getting money from the federal government into the economy in an effective way is a difficult task, no matter who's in charge, no matter what the situation is. And so that's one of the challenges that is out there, and it's one of the reasons why we may see a build back, a second or third bite of the cherry in terms of a big bailout package happening. The other challenge is a lot of the focus so far has been on companies which have a large proportion of their cash flow dedicated to paying people to stop them laying people off. Companies that have large amounts of money invested in capital other than people and still have to pay the bill for that capital. But they're less of a target in some ways, but they still need cash flow to pay for those assets. So there's going to be broad impacts, and we're beginning to assess those broad impacts across the economy. More will come. On page six, this is an international issue. This is not a domestic issue. Everyone around the world is dealing with this. It is important to note, though, the U.S. is ahead of the curve in many senses, in the sense that the U.S. has greater flexibility, has a stronger economy, and was starting from a better place than most of the rest of the developed world, particularly in Europe. Europe is, were we not going through the coronavirus crisis and the oil crisis, the total breakdown of European governing institutions in terms of how they're going to pay the bill, both for the European Union after the UK leaving and now, how they're going to demonstrate solidarity for those countries that are suffering significantly from coronavirus, would be the top news. There's a real challenge in Europe. The European Central Bank is valiantly trying, but they really are pushing on a string. There's a real issue there. And so one of the areas we are particularly concerned about is the impact on developed external to the United States equity markets, because there's real issues that are bubbling under, and the coronavirus problem is making them worse. However, as I said, central banks and governments are doing everything they reasonably can to try and make sure that this doesn't impact too badly. Page 7, we're beginning to think about what a roadmap to recovery looks like. This is a schematic put together by the AEI, but there's lots of others you could use. But the idea is essentially slowing the spread, beginning to reopen maybe state by state, deal with immune protection and containing physical distancing, and then slowly relaxing it, and then rebuilding preparedness for the next pandemic, because I think this has woken everyone up that this is a real ongoing issue we need to be concerned about. We need to think carefully about how long there is between each of these stages, and that's probably going to be a continuing source of discussion. And one of the things that we know is going to happen is the markets are continuing to discuss how to think about what the build-out from here looks like. Thinking about the right framework for this roadmap to reopening is going to be a driver for that kind of successful prediction of where the bottom is, where we're able to stably say things are looking more enthusiastic. A key point in terms of market timing, picking that bottom is always hard. And so we're focused very significantly on not timing the exact bottom, because that's a very difficult thing to do. And indeed, people that try and time the bottom, this is like tossing a coin, whether you're going to be the organization that actually hits the moment. What you really need to do is focus on the when can you have confidence that we are back in an upswing. And that's a much more achievable task. And this kind of framework helps you deal with that and move money, institutional money, appropriately to deal with this kind of environment. Asset class performance, essentially what we've seen has been that the things that you expected to diversify, as long as you were using them in the right way, have indeed diversified. So boring fixed income has reacted in the way you would expect it to. It's been boring, but it's retained its value. And indeed, long treasuries have done extremely well. They've gone up rather than down because of the duration impact. Equities have been hit because they're a risk asset. Some of the funkier bits of credit have been hit because there's risk asset components within that credit. This also has an effect on the foreign exchange market, and there's been significant dollar strength at various points in the process. And so some questions around more sophisticated approaches to deal with currency risk have bubbled up to the surface of the conversation too. It's important that all investors remember page 9, which is that this kind of thing in financial markets happens regularly. We see regular downturns. This was very similar in scale to the downturns we've seen before. We have had many worse downturns than this. It feels painful. It feels uncomfortable. This particularly feels uncomfortable from a behavioral finance standpoint, because people are getting sick, and particularly in an organization such as your own and that of many of our clients, we are one or two steps away from people or organizations who are dealing with the problem directly, who are directly personally impacted, whichever side of the hospital bed they are on. And that makes it more difficult than simply an economic crisis. This is a personal health and human crisis as well as an economic crisis. And that makes the fear element of the fear and greed balance that impacts all of us when we think about markets, that makes the fear element a more easily graspable one, which makes it more of a challenge. So I regularly look at page 9 just to remind myself that, first of all, this too shall pass, and secondly, that this is not an unusual scale of downturn, even though it is a downturn. Scott, maybe I'll pass over to you for slide 10.
Thanks, Ian. So as the title on this slide states, a well-diversified portfolio does help, particularly during downturns and times of market stress. And I just want to refresh everybody's memory that back in 2015, the board started down a path of moving to a functionally focused portfolio, as was pointed out by one of the trustees earlier.
that essentially barbelled the risk of the portfolio to ensure the plan had sufficient liquidity to pay benefits under the worst case scenario, and then much of the rest of the portfolio invested in growth assets to help achieve long-term return targets. If you look at the table on slide 10, you can see the two columns on the left of the table, the interim policy and the long-term policy, the interim policy being reflecting the portfolio as it currently exists today as the plan ramps up illiquid investments, particularly in infrastructure and private credit. And then the point here is that with these three buckets, growth, liquidity, and diversifying buckets, you can see the liquidity bucket at 24% really acts as a buffer, providing a nice cushion to the riskier assets in the growth portfolio, although it's worth pointing out that even the liquidity bucket with short-term government and credit being the primary investment there has experienced some stress in this market environment, but again, certainly providing a nice cushion. And then in the diversifying bucket, the U.S. Treasury, really the great downside protecting asset class, has returned about 10% year-to-date through the end of March. So when the dust settles, although we don't have first quarter numbers yet, but when the dust settles, I expect you'll be very pleased with how your portfolio has performed through this crisis. And with that, I'll turn it back to Ian.
Thanks, Scott. Page 11 then kind of says, how are we thinking about what to do for ourselves and for all of the organizations that we work with? And because alliteration is always awesome, we've stuck with some P's to think about. First of all is people. People are the way in which portfolios get managed, and this kind of environment is incredibly stressful for those people. And that means board members. I'm on three boards myself, and you're aware as a decision maker that you are making decisions and giving input under stressful conditions rather than under easy conditions. It means staff, and it means the people in our organization and similar organizations. So spending time and energy caring for people isn't just the good thing to do, it's the useful thing to do because it helps them make good decisions, it helps them be comfortable about the decisions they're making under difficult conditions, and it helps you be comfortable with the decisions they're making. So we are spending a lot of time on that within our organization. I know investment managers we work with are doing a similar thing, and I'm sure you're doing the same thing. But it's important we say it because it's probably the most important of these three things. Everything else follows from the people. The second thing is the portfolio. And here we're not suggesting a P, which isn't on this page, which is panic, but we're suggesting precisely the opposite, which is process is part of the underlying way of avoiding that panic. So focusing on the different elements of the portfolio. And this is particularly easy to do, in a sense, in your particular portfolio structure, because one of the advantages you have is great clarity about what you're doing. And so the question really is sitting and working through the elements of the portfolio. Are they all working in the way that you expected them to work in this kind of circumstance? What's worked well? What's not worked well? When you see things that didn't work well, why didn't they work well? What was the thing that happened that made them turn out in a way that was different? Was it just one of the unlikely events that might have been predictable, but so you kind of knew it was like possible to happen, but not likely? Or was it something completely out of left field? Or, and this is the time you would get worried, is something broken in your assumption set? And I suspect probably the answer is no for that. Third option, but you need to think those things through, and that provides a framework to bubble things up to the top of the decision making process. And then the third thing is planning.
Excuse me, Ian.
And yeah, please.
Can I just remind trustees to please mute their phones when they're not speaking? Thank you. Okay, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And so the third thing is plans. And here the reason we say plans is because that's a longer term idea. The goal is not to say, what do I need to do this week, although there will be things you have to do this week. The goal is to look out 18 months to 2 years and try and kind of like dieting, something I occasionally try and fail to do, but position yourself as future you rather than present you and say, how do I look after future me or the future of the organization? And say, in 2 years' time, where would I, when looking back, how do I want to be able to describe how we dealt with this as an organization? And that helps you think through the process of what kind of plans do we need to put in place. Are the decisions that we're being asked to make or that we're thinking about, are those the kinds of decisions that 2 years from now when the dust has settled will go, that was the right decision to be making in the right time in the right way? Or are we being swayed by short-term things in the environment that really will have passed and we kind of look back in it and go, well, probably we should just have stuck the course. So that's a good framework to think about in terms of the planning process. And as I say, it comes out of that portfolio assessment of making sure things worked in the way that you thought they would. And then finally, rebalancing is one of those conversations. Thinking through the policy, why is a rebalancing policy necessary? Why is sticking to policy or changing from policy, understanding your policy and understanding active bets you may be making if you are moving away from that policy? So maybe, Scott, if I hand back to you at that point.
Yeah, so just a quick follow-up note on rebalancing. Rebalancing policy becomes really important in distressed markets to help investors overcome their worst instincts and allow flexibility to respond to emerging market conditions. You guys have such a policy in place. You're following it, and you'll be getting an update from Tim in the next agenda item.
And then finally, the final slide on this deck is simply saying other opportunities, because we know that there are opportunities that are going to come out of this event. And we're working through them, as are all investors. But the important thing to note is that the situation, this is not like a typical downturn because of the fact that it's imposed, because of the biological driver behind this, because of the global nature of this, and so on and so forth. So the opportunities that will come up are not necessarily going to be instantly obvious. We know, for example, there is stress in the credit market. There's been a lot of borrowing. Some of that borrowing has been extravagant. Some of it's not been as protected as it might have been. And we know that the credit markets of today are different than the credit markets of 20 years ago. There will be consequences from that. But what those consequences are, who's going to suffer them, and how you can capitalize them on the other side of those problems are not yet clear. Lots of organizations, lots of managers are working the math on it. And they're calling us, I'm sure they're calling staff, or they may even be calling you, with ideas for how to take advantage of dislocations in the market. We've got a working group working on this ourselves. We've got lots of conversations happening. What's clear is that there may be on page one of the 10-page paper on this. So they may have some ideas, they may want to have conversations, but they don't have documents you can see necessarily, that the best ideas aren't even necessarily clear yet. So there's time to deal with this. It's going to work its way through. We'll see things in real estate, we'll see things in the credit market, and so on and so forth. There will be medium and longer term consequences from the experience we're all going through. For example, by the end of this, every single organization, I suspect, that can do working from home will now have done working from home for a material period of time. And many of those organizations historically said, we don't want a working from home policy to be standard. That's a big change, and there will likely be real estate use changes that will come from that. So the answer is capturing the opportunities that will come out. The time will be of the essence when the opportunity presents itself. So you and everyone else like you will need to be able to move rapidly in the context at the time. But that doesn't mean that this is something that has to be done this week or next week in terms of closing on deals, because there's, it will take longer than that for the opportunities to be clear and to be properly structured and made available. So keep a weather eye out for those things, but don't necessarily assume that the opportunities will be there this week or next week, because they'll take time to work through as the situation clarifies. So with that, Scott or Tim, I'll hand back to you, and very, very pleased to answer questions from anyone.
Thanks, Ian. Back to you, Tim.
I have one question, if I could, please. This is Jerry.
Go ahead.
Okay. It's not a key part of the presentation. It's a metric, but it is intended to be providing useful information. So to what extent, if any, do you assign credibility to figures that are coming out of China and Iran on any subject, but especially on the numbers you're presenting?
Yeah.
I take that as you saying none. Okay.
I wouldn't necessarily even be that confident. You have to remember the purpose for which those figures are being put together and released, right?
Right.
The purpose is not the same purpose as figures we get from elsewhere. So it strikes us as bizarrely unlikely that China would shut down the entire education system for the whole country for months, constrain, 75% of their population for months, right, and only have such a small number of people dead. So that just tells you that it's unlikely those two facts work together, and the physical disruption and economic pain caused by the level of economic shutdown they had is so large that that tells you that the sickness and death numbers must have been materially larger. They're also opening up possibly too early. So we're keeping a very close eye on what happens next. Because they're getting back to production. Although when you talk to private equity managers and they talk about what they're seeing on the ground there, you know, numbers like, yes, they're all back to work. And then you get a mumbled, they're at about 60% of what they were before. And you go, oh boy, that's not all the way back to work. So those numbers are not trustworthy. And we have to use other metrics to try and understand the impact.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
And so I want to apologize. I fell off the phone there for a few seconds. Ian, did you finish with your slide deck?
Yes.
Okay, great.
In the Q&A page.
Okay, great. So first off, Gail, is there a member of the public who wanted to comment on this item?
Yes, there's a possible public comment from a journalist named Samuel Karasek from FunMap. If he's on the line, I would like to comment. Okay, I'm not hearing anything.
Nor am I. So I'll go down and give every trustee an opportunity to ask their questions. Candace, do you have any questions or comments?
No, very informative. I appreciate it. And again, going back to our 2015 decision, it has brought me a great deal of peace during this time of turmoil, and especially as I look at things like what's happening with the state and their retirement system. So appreciate the foresight, the leadership that brought us to where we are.
Absolutely. Donnie, did you have anything?
Sorry, just taking a second to flip back over to unmute the phone. Been impressed by having the foresight that the board has showed from the past to be set up to be able to handle some sort of unexpected situation like we're in. So I'm happy to see how things have been going.
Great. Thank you. Scott?
I completely adopt and steal Candace's comments. Absolutely feel the same way, and want to give a shout out to Tim Price for the steady hand through all this. Very, very stabilizing influence, and I feel very comfortable with where we're at relative to other systems.
Great. Thank you. Louis?
Yeah, I want to echo everybody else's statements. It was very informative, and also Varis for giving us this presentation. It's very being informative, and I believe also we did the right thing in 2015.
Great. Thank you. Jay?
No comment. Thanks for the work, everybody.
David?
No additional comment or question.
John?
Just a quick one. This is for Ian. you, in your things to focus on portfolio, has anything jumped out that has not worked well at this point?
No, I wouldn't say. So I'll confine my comments to in general rather than your particular portfolio, if that's okay. But because I'd need to dig deeper for a specific comment. But the general thing is that there's going to be challenges. I think there's challenges in a couple of places. First of all, are the funkier bits of credit where investors have looked at the fact that it sits within a fixed income portfolio and assumed they were getting all of the diversification they would have been if they were buying long treasuries, right? And the functionally focused portfolio structure helps with that because you have clarity as to why you're holding things. But there are some investors who've gently drifted towards having more risk exposure in their fixed income portfolios than maybe they thought they did. So that's one area that I think some investors will need to look hard at. The second, and they did that because of higher return in good times, but then you have concomitant lower return in bad times. Second thing is, I think allocation to illiquidity at times where that illiquidity suddenly bites. So we often say that there is an illiquidity premium, maybe, but there is also a liquidity premium in the sense that having access to liquid capital to allow you to take advantage of discounted assets when they have to be disgorged by other investors, in times of stress, there's a premium associated with the ability to buy discounted assets at times of market turmoil. And so some investors may find themselves in positions where they have excessive illiquidity in the portfolio in a way that they didn't really understand in times of difficulty. And again, the functionally focused portfolio structure helps clarify thinking in a way that reduces the possibility of that being the case, although doesn't guarantee it. So those are two areas that I think we're thinking about: is the funkier bits of credit and the funkier bits of the liquidity structure as two places where investors may be getting more painful surprises than they expected.
Thank you.
Will, do you have anything?
No comment. Thank you.
Okay. Mike?
Oh, nothing for me.
And Rusty? Rusty, did you have anything to add?
Sorry, I have my mute on. No comment, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I have nothing more to add other than I'm certainly glad we took the direction we did in 2015. So with